Hello, lovely podcast people. I hope you are well. I am back to release this guest appearance of mine. I talked about some cool topics in this one, and I'm going to split it into two parts because it's quite long. And in the second part, I talk about aggressive dieting, which I'm getting so many messages at the minute because I am nearing completion of all of the stuff you need to get your hands on the super fancy all singing and dancing aggressive diet calculator 3.0. And so, yeah, also on that topic quickly, please, 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 please don't be one of these people who has, what do they call it? Learned incompetence. not saying that's what it is, but that's one of those. Do you know what that is? Anyway, I'm not going to go off topic right now. But, yeah, you know, I put my story. If you want to come and hear me, so I'm going to do two talks in the UK. I am 75% certain that they are going to sell out instantly, which is why I'm doing two to try and maximize that. I am capping my aggressive diet coaching seminars to small numbers, because I just think it lends itself so well to that. The ones I did in Sydney and Perth and Singapore, the feedback has just been so good, and so many people mentioned that, you know, it's a tough topic to do and well. And I think just people have so many questions that it just lends itself to that. So if you do want to come along to it, you will be the first person, you know, the first group of people to get the calculator. And there'll be benefits to coming to the seminars. I'm not entirely sure what yet, but I've set up a coaching group where I'm essentially hands-on with people, helping them to use it. Because I just, you know, I want it used well. I don't want it to be used in a faddy way, and it's, you know, it's complex. The calculator, you know, it's mostly intuitive in terms of what you need to do with it, but again, there are elements to, if you stick too rigidly to any protocol, this is why most protocols are BS. Anything with the XYZ diet in front of it is, it's too rigid and it doesn't truly help people. And I want this hugely evidence-based, hugely effective method for losing fat, the most evidence-based for losing fat and keeping it off. and this is, you know, some of the stuff I talk about in the seminar, just to help people realize, yeah, this is something I need as part of my arsenal as a coach, or something that I should really try and do well as a client who's maybe failed at other weight loss methods. And not failed at them, but they've failed you because they're not flexible enough, they didn't suit you, and they also don't do the amazing things that aggressive dieting do in terms of getting rid of your hunger, which is the one that people are sort of trying to call me out for. Or is this just based on your opinion, or is there some data behind this? Literally all of it is all the data. None of it's my opinion. So anyway, please don't be these learned helpless people who are just like, oh, here's my email address, can you put me on the list? No, I literally have a link in my bio everywhere where you can go and register your interest. If you just want to hear updates on the calculator, if you want to, you know, anyone who is on my Macmail list, I'm likely going to send something out and say, look, the first few hundred people who buy this are going to get a huge discount. People who come to the seminars will probably get the coaching group free for a little while. Anyway, go on my website, martin-macdonald.com, get your email address in there, and you can get updates. And so I'm going to do these two UK dates, then I'm probably going to do one or two US dates, because I haven't been to the US enough doing my tour stuff and those kind of things. And probably, if there's interest, again, this is why it's important to register your interest. Because if there's not enough interest in Toronto, I won't go there. If there's not enough interest in Dubai, I won't go there. If there's not enough interest in your state, I will go to the states in the US where there is the most interest. So your vote matters, because I'm going to do a quick survey on. And again, you can pick what dates suit you, because I have a few different dates that I'm thinking that I could go and do these. Anyway, this podcast, like I said, I cover some good topics I haven't covered elsewhere. A big focus in this first part about females, you know, some of the issues that females face while they've drawn the short straw with regards to fat loss. So it's a good one in terms of what I say. And yeah, as I say, there's two parts. So hope you enjoy. Much love. I'll put links in this description. If I've said all this stuff here, I'll chuck a load of links in the description for you to get your email address into me in the right place. Again, on Instagram, I now have a broadcast list where I update things. But again, with regards to sending regular emails, again, I don't send regular emails once or twice a month, but you will get the best, you know, you'll just get links on the broadcast list, whereas on the email, you've got more details, etc. Anyway, without further ado, hope you enjoy this one. Until next time, much love.
So Dublin was a couple of weeks ago now, Martin.
Yes, yeah,
Unbelievable talk. So many absolutely great points and the kind of your way of presenting them, using different analogies, bringing that back to kind of case studies, different references and studies was just fantastic. So thank you very much. Thanks. For joining us today.
I appreciate that.
And I saw at the start of that, you said big announcement, something very excited for the collection of your companies.
Yes.
And I was like, ooh, interesting. Then you went on to say about in the weekend in November, you were kind of bringing in some menopause experts and some other female physiology experts. And obviously I was like, that's really cool because that's really interesting for me.
Yeah.
That must be the big announcement. Amazing. I love it. Female physiology getting more attention. Yeah. Like this is so cool. And as cool as that is, that wasn't actually what the big announcement was though. So for those listening that are interested in what you do in terms of the nutrition companies, tell us a little bit about what that announcement was.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll just say as well, because it is a big announcement that Mount Nutrition Live in November, if I can plug it, like 18th of November, we've got two really amazing speakers doing multiple talks on the menstrual cycle, the menopause, periodizing nutrition and training around the menstrual cycle, that kind of stuff. So for us, you know, we work really hard to get the best people, not just anybody talking on these things. So if people want to look that up, Mount Nutrition Live, 18th of November. But the big announcement was Mount Nutrition Uni, our qualification. Do you know what? In Dublin, my sort of senior management were like, do not give it away. Like, don't tell anyone. We've got this whole plan. We need to, you know, get it finalised. But yeah, Mount Nutrition Uni became a government-regulated kind of recognised qualification, which is been a long time coming, and it's not been the goal for me because I guess you might have seen me be a bit scathing about various degrees, university degrees, qualifications, because some are fantastic, lots of lecturers are fantastic, but the qualifications themselves just they tend to be a mishmash of too much rather than we're going to prepare you for X, Y, Z. You know, dietetics, we're going to prepare you to help clinical patients in hospital. That's good. They do that correct. But when it comes to nutrition and helping people, coach them, but the behavior change, the underpinning physiology, nutrition, you know, interventions that we can do and making them work and, you know, specific stuff to like, you know, female population, specific stuff to XYZ goal just isn't done. And they're government recognized, of course. And I'm probably not allowed to say this, but I'm going to. So this is like not an exclusive, and it's not that interesting.
We're not live, so you say whatever you want, and we can always backtrack.
No, don't worry, I never backtrack. stuff like people being able to get public funding, that should just follow. So people being able to take out, you know, things like advanced learner loans and just different funding pots for people to basically get a qualification that I truly believe in. You see other stuff, I'm sure you've seen it, like business coaches, like put this many thousands on a credit card, you know, believe in your business, do it. And I'm like, oh my, I could not do that. Like I send out an email before MNU going, do not enroll if this is going to financially stretch
I've
you.
Because read that email.
Have you?
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I'm sure it literally was like, please do not put this on a credit card.
Yeah.
I was like, that's great.
Yeah, yeah, cool. But I truly believe like that's worth getting that funding and being able to pay it off long term, because it will pay you dividends, because it is, you know, what I believe to be one of, if not the best course in the world. So that was a big announcement. It's all there. It's as far as I know, we're the only one in the world, a level 5 diploma, advanced nutrition science, being able to be a fully qualified and insurable nutritionist. Like for me, it's a dream come true that we've done
it.
It's
incredible.
Yeah.
Before we get into some kind of weight loss and nutrition bits, like, let's touch on that a little bit, if that's okay, because we do have a lot of coaches listen that want to learn how to do right by coaching their female clients, and a lot of aspiring coaches that listen as well. So, I mean, you've just kind of touched on it there as to why it's important, but why is that important that we have an alternative option to going to university to study nutrition in terms of like the real world application? Mm-hmm. Why should people kind of check that course out if they're looking to be the best coach they can, as opposed to just doing the PT qualification and then going, oh, that makes me a nutritionist too?
So the people's goals, they relate to nutrition, and to get the best results, you end up dipping into that more and more and more, because getting them doing stuff cardiovascular wise, getting them to do resistance training, it helps. It's good for one side of the body composition thing, but nutrition is the biggest part that's going to make those massive differences with regards to fat loss. So, going on to the second part of your question, it's like degrees really in nutrition are setting people up really for food industry. So, I've employed a lot of qualified nutritionists, and they know exactly how sausages are made. They know exactly.
Sorry, that really tickled me for some reason. I'm just thinking how pointless.
Yeah, how pointless. That is important knowledge if you're going to work in a company like that. You need to know about food manufacture. And then they do some stuff, but then it becomes like public health policy, which nutritional messages on a public health level have to be different. And I, as a young nutritionist, I criticized them because I was like, oh, that's rubbish, whatever. But it's a difficult job doing stuff at the national level. Like, you've basically one size fits all. What are we going to tell them? Now, my opinion is it's still done badly, and almost less is more. Because when you tell someone something, for instance, base all of your meals on carbohydrate, predominantly starch, one, it gives food industry power to use that information the way that it helps them. But also, it's not a necessary fundamental for health, for instance. So, and we know as humans, we are able to exist on quite a broad spectrum of nutrition, ranging from, very, very plant-based to, more omnivorous, or, close to, I just very, very much dislike the carnivore diet type thing that's going on, because it's not evidence-based. It's certainly not good for human health. But eating more meat, there's a bit of a push away from that, and it's not an issue with, as long as we are adhering to certain fundamentals, principles of the things that we do need for quote unquote optimal nutrition health. So nutrition degrees, they just don't set people up to help people in the real world. Behavior change just becomes a huge factor. The way things are delivered, I'm sure that the counseling side of it, it's not, you're not a counselor, but nutritional counseling is such a big part of just understanding, listening. I use this term, low hanging fruit. And I've just seen this all over it. Loads of people use this term, low hanging fruit. And I'm like, you definitely got that from me. But what is their low hanging fruit? What's the 20% effort that I can get 80% of the kickback of results on my fat loss or muscle gain or health goals? And that's what we do. That's what Mat Nutrition Uni does. It teaches those things. It teaches you the principles. It teaches you also the underpinning of evidence-based practice. So understanding research, how it works, why it's amazing, and then also being able to bring in practitioner expertise and skills and a client-led process or a client-centered focus. And that's why it's a game changer. That's why our graduates are, becoming very intimidating to degree qualified nutritionists.
Yeah, I mean, they're getting jobs in the NHS left, right and center without actually being to go into university, aren't they? Which is incredible.
Yeah. The amount that MNU has been recognized prior to government you know, recognition has amazed me. Like global coaching companies headhunting MNU certified nutritionists. But now you probably saw my Instagram story, like someone said, I work for this private healthcare, something or other. And I
put that CV straight through.
But yeah, that's what they said. They said, as soon as I see MNU, I know their evidence-based. And I'm like, God, all that time I waste on Instagram stories, like where my staff or my management are like, oh, he's on his phone again. I'm like, I'm doing a good job. Like, because I'm showing people what we stand for, what we do, what we, so it is cool. It's nice. It's humbling to know that people, and even hearing like university lecturers there in the US, which it amazes me that anyone's even heard of me there. And they're like, oh, you know, their students are saying, you know, I finished my degree. What should I do now? Should I do a master's? And they're going, go and do MNU. Don't tell my department head, but go and do MNU. And then they do MNU, and then we're sat there at a case studies residential, and I get told these things, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, that is incredible. I mean, that, I don't even know what to say. Yeah. Like, what better marker of your business success could you want than people at, you know, lecturers at university saying, actually go and do MNU instead of doing a master's.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, that's fantastic. Thanks. I mean, we'll circle back around to that at the end and give people obviously all the links and all the upcoming events that you've got. But something you said a minute ago, which was really interesting, which I think is a brilliant segue for what we're going to talk about, is obviously it's a very difficult job to give people blanket one size fits all nutritional advice to the entire population. That pendulum has probably swung too far the other way.
There's
a few things out there at the moment which are problematic. So tell me a little bit about some of the current trends that we're seeing, Martin, and why is it an issue?
Yeah, that's a fantastic segue, I'll tell you.
It's almost like you did that on purpose.
No, I didn't.
Did you not?
I swear I didn't. And it's amazing you've picked up on it. Good.
When you said that, I was like, I'm using that.
Good technique. The world of personalized nutrition has gone mad. And I've suddenly, a few things have just flashed into my brain. So back, I don't know, probably 2002, Charles Poliquin, do you remember him?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay. Not a good person to listen to from almost any nutrition standpoint, but he came up with his thing, biosignature modulation. And I was super taken by it and never practiced or anything, but as in I read about it and I was like, this is amazing if it's true. And he said he'd publish his data, and then even when he died, he still hadn't. And it's like, well, he was a joker. But it was the, you know, if we measure these fat deposition ratios, we can tell what someone's hormonal profile is. And, you know, he came up with all these weird places you'd pinch on the body, as I saw, you know, like kneecap, or, you know, I always make this joke, like, oh, if your, you know, cheek skin fold to your testicle skin fold is out of whack, then it means that you're, I don't know, insulin sensitivity is wrong and you need to take some horny goat's weed or ashwagandha. Like, it was crazy, but it's...
And
it was
bold claims.
Yeah, bold claims and very expensive for the client, but it got buy-in because it seemed personalized. It seemed like, oh, but then at the same time, what did people have to do? Eat zero carbs, a lick of a dried prune, seven days a week, you know, heavy training schedule, calorie control, just lean meats, basically. People lost fat, and it's like, oh, biosignature works. It's like, what? Like, those supplements don't make any difference. And then moving forward from that, my interest, I ended up doing my degree research project within a PhD and a senior lecturer in the realm of genetics, which was horrible at the time because I was just a lowly undergrad, but I was taken by it because it was to do with strength training, which was my sort of passion then. And, you know, we were looking at these genetic polymorphisms, and it was called the angiotensin converting enzyme polymorphism. And then there's these different types you can have that they had related to, like, okay, the 100 meter sprinters, they all seem to have like the double D allele. And then these marathon runners are all the I allele. So II. And then, so basically it was an insanely difficult, you know, research project to write. But again, I'm proud because it ruined my life for a period, but then I you know, got published in Experimental Physiology, and my knowledge of genetics, whilst I'm not a geneticist in any way, shape or form, like, I have a much better understanding of genetics than the average person or the average nutritionist or whoever. And I also understand now DNA testing and DNA diets and what they're basing these results on. And so that was the second part, DNA testing, DNA diets. And I did a bit of myth busting around that, and it's just like, it's BS. It doesn't work. It's, there's, you know, probably more than most of these personalized things, there's a lack of data, research, evidence for it. And then food intolerance testing was my next one. So my master's I did industry funded research within food intolerance testing. And again, that would be so cool if we could test someone's, you know, tolerance, intolerance to certain foods and adjust their diet. That would be fantastic. We could personalize it, you know, it would make life easier. And again, and there's lots of these degree registered nutritionists who are out there doing these tests, giving people results, diets based on them. And it's rubbish. And then moving on from that, in this day and age, we've got the personalized nutrition, the gut microbiome and the blood glucose testing. And it's, my goodness, I almost don't know where to start with it. But what's so super funny, you heard me speak in Dublin, and I obviously explained some of this in more detail and had a bit more time than we do today. But literally on the plane back, maybe, a study has just been published, which basically is like, and I haven't done it enough looking back into the authors, because that's kind of irrelevant for most people, but I'm like, I want to know their bias. Who are these people? What else have they published? What are their beliefs? What are they writing elsewhere? What are they doing in any interviews? Did they want to find results that showed that blood glucose testing was good? But it was a very honest paper, and it basically said personalized testing, blood glucose testing does not help in any way, shape or form. And I don't know if you remember me saying, but a lot of the evidence, quote unquote, evidence-based community sort of say, you know, for healthy people, we don't need continuous blood glucose monitoring. It doesn't help us. There's no viable reason this is going to help us kind of change someone's nutrition and give them good nutrition advice, which will increase fat loss. Or you see these things on Facebook. I'm getting spammed. I think because I interact with the ads, yeah. I get all of them.
So Martin's interested in
this. Yeah, he's interested. You must want to buy this stupid yellow sticker for the back of your arm. What was I saying? So
study was published.
The study was published, and you know, what did they look at? So the evidence-based community are basically like, yeah, it's good, not for healthy people, but for clinical populations, helpful for, you know, type 2 diabetics or pre-diabetics. And I said, I don't agree. I don't think the evidence is there that even for those populations, there is any use. The only use for these monitors is type 1 diabetics. They are an amazing piece of biotechnology to help type 1 diabetics. Anyone else, 0 point. And this study literally showed that. It was like for type 2 pre-diabetic, we are not improving HbA1c. We are not improving fasting blood glucose levels. Basically, this study essentially went standard, and they even used the word one size fits all diet group. And so it was just basically a low fat diet, which most people, if you're working with a group of individuals that are, you know, insulin resistant to some extent, we probably want them to be eating maybe slightly less carbohydrates. And I won't go into why I say probably so much there, because, or I will very quickly, we can still make someone a lot more insulin sensitive eating a lot of carbohydrate. We can do it. It's easy. It's been done. I had a debated Tim Noakes on a podcast, and you know, he's super, you know, he's keto. Keto's the only thing. And he didn't quote a single study in like an hour and a half podcast. And I was just quoting study after study, and he just basically like, look, no, I've not quoted any studies, but you know, I know I'm right, and you'll see. And I was like, oh my god, this is an A rated scientist, like 50, 60 years old. I'm like, oh my goodness. But in this instance of this study, one size fits all, and then a personalized diet based on computer learning algorithms, continuous blood glucose monitoring. I don't think they used microbiome stuff, but that's, you know, BS. Literally, it's Do you have swearing in your podcast?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I mean, just people rooting through your shit. Like, yeah. No, I'm joking. But, the gut microbiome doesn't work. So this study, they essentially go, there's no difference whether we just do a blanket one-size-fits-all diet or this super expensive, annoying, fancy personalized nutrition. And that, all the studies that these, they're not showing what you would think they are, like considering how big it is, the investment it's getting, the adverts you see, oh, it's changed my life, I no longer have menopausal symptoms. Like, what? Not, that isn't a thing. And the microbiome stuff, that's even worse. There's just, we don't know anything about the gut microbiome, really. We have some rough ideas that, oh, when you lose weight, it seems to change. When you eat less or more red meat, it seems to change. We don't know what those changes mean yet. And when you eat a food that, thousands, tens of thousands of different, biochemical processes, and we don't know what they do. Yet someone can go, oh, because of this change in your gut microbiome, you shouldn't be eating kale, but you should have some broccoli. Like, it's ridiculous. So, yeah.
It is. Out of all of those listed, the one that I think I've seen people use the most and tell me about the most is the food intolerance test.
Mm.
So if possible, Martin, just take a few minutes to tell the listeners kind of like what that test is for, why it doesn't work,
yeah.
And why doesn't it actually not tell us anything useful.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I did skip over that a little bit. So food intolerance testing, typically, there's a few different ones. There's a super new weird one, which I think they call the mediator release test. And generally what these tests are based on is immunological things. So the one my research was based on was IgG, immunoglobulin G. And these IgG tests are essentially telling us you have eaten this food. So your body has recognized this food that you've eaten, and it's raising the level of this immunoglobulin. And what is then being done, which is completely wrong, people shouldn't be doing this, is going, that's your body doing, activating the immune system. So it's bad for you and you shouldn't be doing that. And then they'll start going, and it's causing inflammation. Everyone just loves that word. It's causing inflammation and then making up stuff in terms of what inflammation does. And it's just not the case. So within my research, what we found was we actually did these tests, industry funded. So again, the company who funded it, I won't say who it was, but just to say we didn't get to publish our results. So that's another thing. Like, we showed it was BS and then we didn't get to publish our results. And so we essentially did, we validated a questionnaire that looked at people's actual real life symptoms. They then did this ELISA test and then we got their results. And there was like a list of however many foods, and it came up with different strengths of intolerance. But it's not, it's just measuring the amount of these IgG immunoglobulins. And what we found was someone would be like, I drink loads of milk, and then it would be like, do you have any issues with drinking milk? No. And then milks is like the most intolerant thing for them. But what happens is, and I will say this because this is where people get misled, oh, I feel really bloated, I've got bloating, or my tummy's whatever. And then these tests, it comes up with a whole load of foods, like 50 foods, like pretty much everyone's intolerant to like every food, but just different amounts. Because if you've eaten the food, you're probably going to have this response. And then someone's like eating, just boatloads of bread, like I absolutely love tiger bread. So, a loaf of tiger bread a day, and then it says, oh, you're intolerant to that. And I stop eating a loaf of tiger bread a day and I go, ooh, bit less bloated. Like, yeah, because you cut a load of foods out. And just this is the same with people who are obsessive about fasting or obsessive about low carb, or even the whole carnivore thing. What these things are non-specific elimination diets. One, you eat less. Two, if you do have any actual real life food sensitivities, because I'm not saying food sensitivities don't exist, okay, they do. We just don't have the test for them. We have something like hydrogen breath test for lactose intolerance. That's a thing. But whether or not you should or shouldn't eat strawberries, whether or not you should or shouldn't drink milk, And I say strawberries because you wouldn't believe how many people are intolerant or on this stupid test to strawberries. Like, all these people are like, what? I love strawberries. I don't have any issues. And it's like, you're five on this scale of you are 5 out of 5 intolerant. Don't eat them. So these things don't work. And it's not to be confused as well with allergy tests, because we can test allergies. But the other thing is, you know if you've got a peanut allergy, because you end up in hospital. No. Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame. These intolerances is, we still can't really fully define what an intolerance is, because is it that, for instance, someone who struggles or has been diagnosed with IBS, for instance, and specific foods, specific fermentable carbohydrates, like onions is a big one for so many people. And the so these things, FODMAPs, a whole set of foods that ferment, and some people, the different foods will get them more than others. There are lots of different foods contain FODMAPs, but some foods specifically, for some reason, and it may well be to do with their gut microbiome, the bacteria in there that are doing this fermenting, is doing that more so with that food, and they'll feel, you know, some, they'll become symptomatic after eating those foods. So again, we could say, you know, someone's intolerant to onions. They're not really intolerant, but they're getting unwanted side effects from eating that food. And but again, these, we don't have these tests. And unfortunately, what this brings us back to is a really boring and arduous task, if you do have issues with food, to, you know, using food diaries, using, really, you want to work with a qualified practitioner to go through this process, because it is difficult. You know, well, we have clients that have come to us over the years, and they've spent 10 years just not knowing what's going on. And then you have this other big issue of stress. Mm-hmm. Like, stress is another thing that can activate these IBS type symptoms. Yep. And people are like, I'm fasted, I haven't eaten anything, and I'm getting the stomach pain or the whatever. So it is good to like go out and get some help if you're really in that realm, and don't go to these companies that are selling you these, you know, quick fix, £100, £200 tests that again can also leave you in a place with just a very limited diet, because they've told you to cut all these things, and magically, you know, it told you to not eat 25 things, and one of them was a real thing that made you feel worse, but you've cut out 25 foods, and there are actual, that it's not an inert process, because when you reduce a lot of food, you reduce your dietary variety and even your fiber variety, which can then impact your the variety of your different gut microbes, which, you know, again,
it's ironic, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's one of the few things we probably do know about the gut microbiome.
Is that we probably want to be eating aware of these different foods that do this. We don't know exactly how to change it to be optimal, but we know we probably shouldn't be cutting a whole load of those foods out.
There's so many amazing points that I want to circle back around to, in particular the one on stress and digestion, because I think that's just a correlation that most people just don't understand and have never heard of. But if we've clearly done an amazing job there of painting the picture. So if you're someone listening, you're probably looking to these different tests or different methods one or two ways. We've either maybe got some health symptoms, or they're looking at it from to help with weight loss perspective, which obviously is then two different situations, two different answers.
Yeah.
So you've started touching on the health side of it a little bit there, in terms of, well, what would we do instead? It'd be an elimination diet. But yeah, if you are someone listening and you've maybe looked at different microbiome tests, stool tests, food allergy tests, etc. in the past, just elaborate a little bit more on what we actually would do instead, if you are someone experiencing symptoms of that. So, okay, Martin, if those tests don't really work.
And is this going from sort of that health aspect as opposed to fat loss?
Yeah, and then we'll kind of cover it from a why that's not relevant from a weight loss perspective, cool, because it doesn't influence calories.
Yeah, cool. So essentially, yeah, those tests don't work. So the difficult thing is here is, you know, you mentioned stress, and then we've got different reasons that foods might be impacting us. Only one of them is... So IBS is such a kind of sad diagnosis for someone to get, because it's so complex, and it's almost, this upsets some kind of medical professionals when I say this, but it's almost just like, we don't know what's wrong with you, so you got IBS. And, there's very specific criteria that's used, and IBS-C, constipation, IBS-D, diarrhea, IBS-M, which is mixed, which, I mean, then it's just like, God, you're just, which are you? Like, you'd think you'd be one or the other, but then it's just... So, honestly, this is one of those areas. I mentioned dietetics earlier. Like, this is one area. If you and it's not just any dietitian, unfortunately. It's going and finding someone who specializes in this area and helping people and getting to the root of... Because it genuinely could be something. We had a client who... And we're actually having our MNU. We have a clinical module, and we get criticism from this from people going like, because we have an eating disorders. We cover eating disorders, PCOS, IBS, diabetes, obese populations, a few others, and people essentially say, "Oh, you're teaching your nutritionist to work with people with eating disorders." Like, no, because I'm not an idiot. But the fact that people omit teaching in this area is stupid because, you know, it's like personal trainers often go outside their scope of practice. But then you've got nutritionists going outside of their scope of practice. And having a lack of understanding means that you're not able to identify it to refer. You also don't understand what you shouldn't do, which might lead to more disordered eating patterns or, you know, eating disorders. You know, it's very complex. So we teach them that because they understand scope of practice. Our graduates understand when to refer. They understand spotting, you know, the difference between binge eating and binge eating disorder and actually, okay, this is starting to look like it could be this. I need to get some help. I need to maybe start encouraging the client down a certain route. So that's why we teach that stuff. Going back to, you know, so IBS is one of our lectures and... We've got, I suppose I can say this, yeah, Rachel Hobbs, who's an amazing registered dietitian, and she's coming in to deliver on that. And again, just a wealth of experience in that area. So it's kind of annoying for people, my advice, but it's sadly the advice that works. So I mentioned earlier about MNUs being asked to do these different things. So binge eating disorder, it's just, you know, it especially since 2020, eating disorders across the board went up, and there just simply aren't enough practitioners to deal with and help people. And one of the sad things throughout my whole career has been this thing, horizontal aggression. Basically, you see a personal trainer or a dietitian who, you know, they're like, "Oh, we're the only ones who should give nutrition advice." And then you've got registered nutritionists who are like, "Oh, we're kind of just as good as dietitians." It's like, you're definitely not. But then you've got some lowly personal trainer who's giving good advice. It's all correct, but they're like, "You shouldn't be talking about nutrition. You're not qualified." And it's like, why are you having to go at him or her? Like, they're doing a good thing. If you maybe weren't so aggressive and insular, you could actually, and this is why I've built this amazing network of registered nutritionists, registered dietitians, you know, doctors, whoever, who want to, they know the power that they hold, what they can help with. They can essentially have people feeding underneath them and you know, mentoring and, you know, being able to actually reach a wider group of people and actually build those relationships. And that's, you know, we've managed to do that through our mentoring lab and through our graduates. And, you know, now we are, I think I can probably say this, but we've essentially been headhunted for this Public Health England initiative, essentially for MNU graduates to basically be supporting this new huge self-help binge eating disorder program. So they will be part of a multidisciplinary team, and so we can actually help a much larger group of people now, because we're not relying on like psychiatrists, who are there very few of, and eating disorder specialist dietitians and psychologists. Going back to this scenario of what can people do, it's like there are limited the good dietitians out there who are going to help you with these things, but it's where you should go with it. You know, you should seek these people out, because there are people putting out good stuff on Instagram. You can do some self-help in this area, read up on it, but don't go for someone selling you a supplement. Don't go for someone, you know, they've got the answer, because there's just no one answer for this sort, you know, this very multifactorial issue that people are getting, you know, with their guts. Like, gut health is such a selling point. And if you ever see anyone who's just like a glorified personal trainer going, "Oh, I, you know, there's a particular one, I'm not going to name him because I don't like giving him any airtime. But you know, like the Chinese medicine, you know, he's big into all in the homeopathy and just like, well, I'll fix your gut and this, that, and the other. And it's just, it's really, really immoral, really, what they're doing. So, yeah, look for these sort of, it's the only time qualifications I think are particularly good. It's like, yeah, okay, go down the doctor route. And the problem is people go to their doctor and then referrals take forever, depending on what country you're in. But this is one of the great things about social media. There's lots of bad things, but one of the great things is you can connect with some people who are legitimately qualified, putting out good information. You can maybe self-help a little bit in that area.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I think it's really important to emphasize that point on finding the right person to help with it, because health symptoms can be complex. And as you mentioned earlier, it can really tie back into relationship with food, and people actually can really give themselves disordered eating trying to fix this themselves. So working with a professional is an answer that I'm very, very much obviously in agreement in. So I think that's fantastic. Yeah. And then let's get into kind of from a weight loss perspective. Firstly, I'm genuinely really intrigued. Why do you think people are so drawn to these types of testings, methods, restricted diets from a weight loss perspective? Why do they not really work? And what should we be looking to do instead?
Yeah, so I did a podcast on this, on my own podcast, not another nutrition podcast, a little plug. And it's the thing I said earlier about, and maybe I did make this point well, but when you feel like something's personalized to you, so lots of these personalized nutrition, blood glucose monitoring and microbiome testing, and similar to the DNA type diets, they create buy-in because people feel like snowflakes and they feel like, ah, that's what I was missing. So someone goes, eat vegetables. You know, the whole public health messaging. Like I've got this thing, I try and make science sexy, make learning fun, make, nutrition education fun. And not just go, you should be eating vegetables, because it's boring. You know, someone else goes, based on your DNA and your specific makeup, you need to eat vegetables. Be like, no way, I would never have guessed. And it's like, what? The advice these stupid tests are giving you. And I will say that, I skipped over earlier, but the data behind the blood glucose testing, you know, continuous blood glucose monitoring, the yellow patch on the arm that you're seeing around now, it's pretty much giving every single person the same diet. It literally favors a lower carbohydrate, kind of higher protein diet, like no processed foods, and then some weird middle ground stuff, like it will randomly tell someone to eat one vegetable, not another, and just random stuff, which is just noise to make it seem a bit personalized. And then not like someone sat there doing it, they have got a computer algorithm. It's just, it's based on BS data. Like it's, if you feed a computer just rubbish, I don't know if you've, like, some of the whole new AI stuff, like when whatever this ChatGPT, like, because of the information that it's able to get its hands on and read, it kind of ends up picking up rhetorics. And so you ask it certain things and it's like, oh my goodness, even like ChatGPT's even been is succumbed to like propaganda and a way of talking about things. Like, I don't know, there's some stuff on sexism where it's basically, it protects women, doesn't protect men. And it's random. Like you ask it these questions. Anyway, it's kind of off topic. So if you feed the wrong data in, these things don't work. So people are led to it because it's personalized to them. They've paid money for it and it seems sexy. It seems, this is what I've been missing all along. And they have motivation in the short term. So it tells them to do something, they stick to it, and oh, I get some results. And there's different reasons different things will work. So depending on, you know, you mentioned a number of different things people are led by, like fad diets or the personalized testing, and there's different reasons that they'll one, choose to do it. But the problem is because the truthful answer is not nice to hear. And it's not easy to change. So, you know, when you get told you need to do the boring things consistently over a long period of time, and, you know, you heard me talk on my tour a lot about, again, genetics. Like, we're all dealt a different hand of cards. And essentially, the goal should be to play that hand of cards as well as possible. But we don't do that. We compare ourselves to someone else. We compare ourselves at this time point, but we also compare our progress to someone else. And if it's different, it's like, there's something wrong with me. There's a piece of my puzzle I'm missing and I need to find out what that is. And it's not. It's just, that's you. That's your genetics. That's your body. That's your physiology. That's your gender. You know, I speak a lot about the difference between males and females. And I don't know when I was randomly pondering this, but it was in the last day or two. I just had these random conversations in my head, but like, what gender would you rather be? If you could pick being a male or a female, what would you pick? And then I was like, lots and lots of different pros and cons. But you know, from a physiology perspective, it often sucks to be a female. And you know, that's, you know, people talk about the patriarchy BS, like it's a load of crap, but there are things where I talk about the fact that we don't have enough research in women. And why is that? There's legitimate reasons. It's not like, oh, misogyny, it's because people hate women. It's like, no, they don't. Everyone loves women. But women are difficult to study because of the menstrual cycle and because we want to control for factors. And it's hard to control when someone's got they're different every week of the month, whereas males don't have the same issues. So this, going back to kind of your question of like where people are led to, it's like, it's the boring stuff. And so if people can understand, yeah, they're on this genetic continuum and no fancy method, you know, you're being led to that because you don't want to, and people have failed, you know, quote unquote failed so many times. And it's not that they've failed. It's like, oh, I failed on that diet. You didn't fail on that diet. That diet failed you. That shake diet failed you. That person just selling you a one-size-fits-all aloe vera, clean nine, whatever that flipping heck, like the diarrhea diet didn't work for you. Like, oh, no way. And so people want that magic bullet because the thing that genuinely works is the hard work thing or the slow results thing. So there's so many different ways I could go with this answer, but that's why people are going for it, because it just, they want something else that's a bit more, they want the magic bullet, not the truth.
Yeah. And what is that truth then, Martin? So yeah, what do we actually need to do if someone's got, looking at it predominantly kind of from a weight loss perspective, yeah, where would we start? And obviously there's nothing inherently different between how men and women, you know, lose body fat or how or why we create a calorie deficit. But if there is any kind of extra considerations you think are relevant from a female physiology standpoint, then obviously with a mostly female audience, feel free to kind of elaborate on those a little bit as well, if that's okay.
Yeah. So from a fat loss perspective, you make a good point. There's no difference in the principle. And that principle is to use a term people don't use often, like a negative fat balance in the body. So there's more fat leaving our system than is going in. And that's not fat going in necessarily as dietary fat, because we can make a tiny little bit of, it's very, very difficult for our body actually to make fat from carbohydrate, but that can go in. And also, there's different considerations with the different macronutrients. But essentially, if we then break fat and these components down into energy, like the flux of energy in and out of our system, our dynamic system, you know, people talk about calories or energy, you know, whatever unit you want to use. And these aren't, you know, people go, you know, the calorie lie, or, you know, I don't know what the crazy, you know, in thing for calling it at the minute is. It's just, but it is on a thermodynamics, on a physics basis, there's more energy within this system than, and you need more going out than coming in. And that's what we very simply call a calorie deficit if we're wanting to lose fat. And so how do we create that? There's 101, a million and one different ways. And that's a big part of coaching. That's a big part of, you know, why I said these registered nutritionists, the podcast I did, they don't know how to coach people. So how do they get buy-in from their clients? they sell food intolerance testing things, and that makes people cut out a bunch of foods and they lose weight. This is the other thing: when you lose weight or you eat just less food in general, oh, my bloating's improved. Well, you're in a calorie deficit. That does a lot of stuff to the body. How do we do that? We have to find something that is going to work for us. And